हरिः ॐ सहना भवतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
So somehow or another we couldn't get the other half of the document that you have here now printed out, so I have one that I'll start through, and then we'll give it out on Thursday, and then if there's anything from there, from looking at it, that you want to redo, then we'll do. So this is basically another 22 pages of the same document. So now we skip to the 8th chapter. And in the 8th chapter, then they're dealing with the legal titles that the kings would work with. Because the king, then there's 18 titles of the law that the king will deal with. And then those 18 titles then are what he will see in his daily court. Like every day, then in the morning, starting like at early morning, after his sadhana is done, then he sits in the court with his ministers, and then they deal with all the legal titles that are there. So then, in there, then there are some sections that deal, that have, you know, importance for the discussion. So then in legal title 8 is if there is any, somebody is not happy with the transaction, like that. So in there then, in that there may be some dissatisfaction in the marriage arrangement. So the first one is then, if, because the marriage being arranged, and very much in the tradition many times, because the families are satisfied, those being married are satisfied with the arrangement, whatever their parents make, then sometimes it is seen that the person, the father of the girl, may then show one girl but give another in the marriage, because you don't see them until the marriage actually starts. Like that. So, because the girl comes out veiled. So it's only after she's gone around 7 times, then the cloth will be taken off. So if at that time it's seen that the girl is different, then one can annul the marriage right at that point. So that point is being made. Right? And the person who does that will be fined. Because that shouldn't be done. That's not the way it does. Like that. And then another point is that if there's something wrong with the girl that wasn't explained, like that, she has some very serious disease or some very, you know, serious physical defect, or is not a maiden, like these kind of things, then it has to be known beforehand. If they're known, then no one can complain. But if they're not known, then it can be a problem, because the family has one consideration. And then if it's not, then that should be... The idea is that on these transactions there should be an openness. There should be like that. Then so that says, but the king shall impose a fine on him who gives a blemished damsel to a suitor without informing him of the blemish. Then 8.2.25, but that man who out of malice says of a maiden, she is not a maiden, shall be fined 100 panas if he cannot prove her blemish. Like that. So if a man makes a statement, or you know, that a girl is not pure, if he can't prove it, then he'll be fined. In other words, it's not allowed that people can just make comments about others. You know, in other words, defamation is considered one of the five main criminal activities. Like that. So it's never tolerated in the Vedic cultures, defamation. So here, if then a man defames a woman, then if he can't prove it, then he'll be fine. It's not just, oh, I made a mistake. It won't be left at that. He'll be fine. Yes. There's, let's see, defamation, violence, I think, theft, adultery, and do you remember the fifth one? Is it gambling?
Yes.
I think it's gambling. Like that. We'll go through those from the, I mean, oh, I think it comes, I think it's just at the end. After adultery, let's see, I think there's a verse. There's a verse that closes it up. Yes. Okay. That king in whose town lives no thief, no adulterer, no defamer, no man guilty of violence, and no committer of assaults attains the world of Indra. Like that.
What are they called? What?
These are all criminal. Yeah. It means, in other words, the law that he deals with it is in his 18... titles of the law. Then you have civil law, you have domestic law, and you have criminal law. Like that. So these three are dealt with, these three main areas. Like that. Okay. Okay, now it mentions that because then the next one, the full nuptial texts are applied solely to virgins and nowhere among men to females who have lost their virginity. So the principle being is that the full text, because in the full text, then there are mantras such as the husband is receiving the girl from the demigod, straight from the fire. So if she has already been with another man, then that mantra wouldn't be used. Or if she's already been given by the father to somebody, and then there's a remarriage, those mantras wouldn't be used. In other words, things that have already been done before, certain things can only be done once. Right? So those parts of the text won't be used. But certain parts, it doesn't matter, those are always used. You know, the exchanging of garlands, seven steps around, exchanging of places, the sindur covering the head, putting the foot on the stone, offering the puffed rice, going around the fire, the seven steps. Those are done. Those are always done. But all the other ones then depend upon the nature of the position of the girl. If it's the first time she's being married, then they'll all be used. If it's a second time, then they would not be all used, because some of them only apply to the first marriage. Does that make sense? They just apply there. They don't apply to beyond that. And other ones, but those ones that don't apply aren't the main marriage. Does that make some sense? There's all kinds of mantras that are preliminary to the marriage or concluding of the marriage, but are not the actual main part of the ceremony itself. So those may change, because those are like samskaras that are done. Once they're done, they're done. Right? Once the girl has been purified of any difficulties in, let's say, having children, or in being Krishna conscious, or dealing properly with wealth, once those samskaras are done, they're done. They don't have to be redone. So they won't be done at another marriage. But the actual main thing of the marriage, that has to be always done, no matter what the situation is. Does that make some sense? So that's the meaning here, is that the full text only apply to a virgin being married the first time. After that, then some of the texts are dropped, like that, depending upon the situation. The nuptial texts are a certain proof that a maiden has been made a lawful wife. But the learned know that they and the marriage ceremony are complete with the seventh step of the bride around the sacred fire. The texts are there, but what he's saying is there's so many beyond the seven steps, there's more parts of the marriage. But with completing the seventh step, the husband and wife are married. They're husband and wife at that time. Everything else after that is simply concluding rites. There's nothing beyond that. There's also another one that says that the marriage, I think we did that before, that the marriage ceremony is there actually for purification. But when the father gives the girl, or when the girl is betrothed, at that time the father's authority over the daughter is transferred to the boy. like that. So then at betrothal, then the fiancé becomes the authority for the girl, not the father. Like that. Then when they're married, then that was the, you know, confirmation of that. And within marriage, then when the seven steps are completed, the marriage rite is done. Like that. So that's the main aspect, is the offering of Laj and the seven steps. These are the main parts of the wedding. So then, legal title 15, then adultery. The men who commit adultery with the wives of others, the king shall punish and afterwards banish. Like that. So we'll kind of get an idea that in the Vedic culture, adultery is not overly taken overly kindly. That's what's happening here? For by adultery is caused a mix of the castes, varna, among men. Thence follows sin, which cuts up even the roots and causes the destruction of everything. So this is what Arjuna was talking about. Arjuna was having a problem, because if this battle happens, then all the men will be killed. Men are killed, the women are not protected. The women aren't protected, then you get Varnashankara. Varnashankara will destroy the society. So here's the law on which he was basing his argument. Is that when there's a mixture of the castes, that's then when the society becomes ruined. Because then you have people doing what they shouldn't be doing, wrong understandings, everything like this, and then they'll just make a complete mess out of the whole thing. So that's why adultery is seen bad. Because the problem in adultery is people aren't choosing someone who is equally matched by nature, this, that. That's one thing. You know, it's just wherever there's availability or wherever there's interest. Right? So it doesn't look at that. Just there's mutual attraction and common, how you say, opportunity, then that is where it may happen. So it's not dealing with these aspects. So it doesn't give a good result. Second thing is, because it's outside of marriage, then whatever you get will be an unpurified soul. It won't be. Not only that, then if it's illicit, then that is when the ghosts are given opportunity to enter the womb. That is how they get out of ghost bodies. Is that they can enter wombs where there's illicit sex, like that. So you can't get a purified soul by illicit sex, like that. It's guaranteed you get a ghost, like that. As devotees, maybe real devotee ghost, because we've seen, even we know of, just in the last so many years, devotees, you know, kill themselves, this, that. So they're there. Devotee ghosts are there. You know, yes.
Maharaj, what's the difference between outside marriage and impure self and illicit sex?
They're the same. I was just making it obvious. Like that. Means if it's in marriage, they've been legally married, then they won't get ghosts. But if they're not, if things aren't properly arranged, then they may get a soul who's not that pure. But they'll always get, you know, a non-ghost. But someone who outside of marriage begets a child, then the general principle is they'll always get a ghost. Like that. Like, maybe if there's no ghost available, then something else will have to be arranged. But in other words, it can't be good because it's based on lust. It's not based on duty. So therefore, whoever they get will have a very strong aspect of lust. You know? That's there. It's even acknowledged, like you see in the Scarlet Letter. You know, you've heard of that one? So in there, the girl who's telling the story is the daughter from that illicit relationship. And she's saying that about how that passion was there burning in the parents, and that passion burns in me also. That's like her conclusion of the whole thing. So there's just passion like that. That's the whole thing. It's because it's based on passion, the child will have that passion. Then the difficulty comes is then whether they'll be able to apply that passion properly. You know, because being unpurified, the tendency will be not to. So only by good association and that can you get somewhere. But, you know, but that still depends on the individual's, how you say, commitment to make it work. Therefore, these things are looked down upon so heavily in the Vedic culture because there's a chance they won't. You know, and then what? You know? Like you hear of great souls being born by these kind of situations. But those are exceptions, not rules. Right? Satyakama Jabala. His mother, Jabala, was a prostitute. But he was a great soul. Like that. Or you have these Shakuntala. You know, or these other. Because in those ages, then Gandharva would be an okay marriage. Yeah, like this. But those are things where it's Gandharva marriage. See, the problem is in Kali Yuga, Gandharva marriage is outlawed. Because it won't have that sense of duty behind it. On the other ages, it was they were mutual agreement, but that sense of duty was there, but still it was considered inferior. Like that. You know, and it could be used among Kshatriyas. You know, for them, there was not a problem, Gandharva. Because the sense of duty and that sense of passion, so it matched very nicely. Brahmins generally wouldn't use it. So Satyavati, she's a Kshatriya. She's the daughter of Upari Charavasu. Like that. So she was a Kshatriya. So then Parasara using Gandharva marriage with her was not a problem. Like that. So it's agreed that this is there. And the marriage works and like that. So it's not considered the best, but it's workable in the other three ages. But in Kali Yuga, it just doesn't give a good result.
So out of duty is still not governing the ashram. You said a child be gotten out of duty. What does that mean?
Means out of duty means that there is the principle that they're going to have the child for the performance of religious rites, and that the child themselves would be religious. It means there's some thought about the child, because then there's a common principle between the husband and wife. So when the mood is the same, then the child is the same. But if the moods of the two parents are different, then the child will have both those differences. So that makes confusion for the children. You know, the adults don't feel it, but the child will. So you get two different mentalities happening in the same person. Because the parents were in two different mentalities. So that's the whole idea, the Garbhodhan Samskar, that planning of the child, puts them in the same frame of mind. And then from that, then the child will have one focused frame of mind. So then they'll be, it's easier for them to make. So that's the differences in the Vedic. The consideration is the child. In the modern, the consideration is the union between the man and the woman. Their satisfaction is the main thing. But in the Vedic, it was producing a proper child. Because the Vedic, it's understood, you put a man and woman together, you get a child. That's the purpose and result of that intimate interaction. The modern is, that interaction is for happiness. And then somehow or another, they can't figure out why, but it kind of one of those annoying things that happens is that children are produced, you know? So it's not connected that you engage in this activity, you get a child. It's not seen like that. It's just, you know, it's just like you eat, you get full. You know? Like that. So that's that. That is natural. And if you say that, it says that's obvious. But the Romans worked on a different principle than that. Right? And then most people say that's hedonistic. So if that's hedonistic, where the thing that, what it does, then you remove, and then keep doing it, then what would be the difference between that hedonism implied on eating and that hedonism implied on mating? You know what I'm saying? So it's just a matter because of that desire, then their intelligence is lost. So it's not seen. So that's the whole principle, is the Vedic, it understands it will give a child, therefore the child is being what's wanted, then the whole thing is planned. Like let's say you want to have a nice meal, right? You plan it, isn't it? You plan what you want, you buy the things, you figure out if you have all, how much time it'll take, you know? It's planned. And if it's just like, you know, you're sitting around and with a friend and then saying, hey, why don't we eat something? Okay, and then you go look in the fridge, look at the cafe, what can we put together? Okay, yeah, why not? You know? It may be a nice interaction between those two people, but what you prepare isn't necessarily something so special. Does that make sense? So the two people have had a nice time, but it's not there. But if you want them to have a nice time and get a good result, that means planning. So that's why the Vedic culture is planned, because it's like, okay, great, you had 5 minutes of fun, and then what about the next 20 years living with the thing? You know, that may or may not be fun. So that's why the Vedic principle is, it knows the two don't add up. You know, you can't say that the one balances the other. You can't say 20 years balances a few moments. Like that. It just doesn't add up. The two don't match. So the Vedas, knowing that, then they are very strong in this point. Therefore, this section you'll see is quite strong on this point of adultery. Does that make sense? Is that all? Okay. So then here we have. Okay. Then the next. A man formerly accused of such offenses, who secretly converses with another man's wife, shall pay the first or lowest amercement. Sometimes he mentions here that there's different amercements. Means that's amounts of money. So if it just says the amercement, then it doesn't give the detail. So lowest amercement, I think, is... I think it's 250 panas, like that. We were trying to work out, but we still have to contact the goldsmiths to work it back. Because they give a certain volume. It's all by weight, and then it's all paid by that. But we haven't gotten what it is on the gold market to work it back. So it's 250. The next amercement is 500. The next amercement is 1,000. So like we see before, it said it'll be fined 100 panas. So that's lower than the first amercement. You know? Otherwise, then it'll either say an exact amount, or it'll just say first, second, or third. Like that. But a man not before accused who thus speaks with a woman for some reasonable cause shall not incur any guilt, since in him there is no transgression. In other words, someone who's been accused of adultery before and is seen talking with someone else's wife, and he's been told not that he'll be fined. But someone is seen talking with someone's wife, but he's never been accused, and there's a reasonable cause, that won't be counted as adultery. Does that make sense? So in other words, they just take him because he's been accused, therefore there's a good reason that's why he's talking like that. These are the forms of adultery. He who addresses the wife of another man in a tirtha outside the village, in a forest or at the confluences of rivers, suffers the punishment for adulterous acts, samgrahana. So it's like these are places where, why would they be there? Right? It means they've gone to meet there. You know, because generally these places are not outside the village, right? Why are the two of them outside the village? Right? If he's from in the village, so they go out for getting water. The women will go down to the river for that, but they have their own place. Men have another place. So how would the man be at that place with that woman? Right? So in other words, these kind of aspects. Offering presents to a woman, romping with her, touching her ornaments and dress, sitting with her on a bed, all these acts are considered adulterous acts. If one touches a woman in a place which ought not to be touched, or allows oneself to be touched in such a spot, all such acts done with mutual consent are declared to be adulterous. Thus the wives of all the four castes even must always be carefully guarded. Right? So this applies for everyone. So he's making the point, it's not just that this is something for Brahmins or the Dwijas, but this is for all. Those who are Aryans, those who are followers of the Vedic culture, they're careful about this. The tribals, that's their own business. Mendicants, bards, men who have performed the initiatory ceremony of a Vedic sacrifice, and artisans are not prohibited from speaking to married women. Yeah, because these ones are different. Someone else's husband, what does he have to do with this person's wife? But your sannyasis, your the singers and that who come for, you know, special programs, they come for marriages, this, they glorify, they eulogize. Or they may be in the court, they eulogize and all that. Men who perform the initiatory ceremony of Vedic sacrifice means the house has invited them as to be their priest for a ceremony. So then naturally a lot of the ingredients are arranged by the women of the house. So they can talk artisans because they come to, you know, make furniture, curtains, sewing, make ornaments, these things. They can talk with them because they have business. In other words, those who have business can talk. Those who don't have business shouldn't be talking. Right? And this is, you'll notice here, it's also included married men. In other words, married men shouldn't be talking to others' wives unless there's a purpose. If there's a purpose, there's no problem. But if there isn't, then it's not that just because they're married man, then they can talk to anyone they want. It's not a license for that. They have a license with their own wife, not with everybody else's. Does that make some sense? Like that. That's the... Let no man converse with the wives of others after he has been forbidden to do so. But he who converses with them in spite of a prohibition shall be fine. So if somebody's uncomfortable that someone's talking with their wife, and he tells them you don't, then he shouldn't. You know, maybe there's been nothing wrong, but there's some discomfort there. So then, if they talk again, then they'll be fine. This rule does not apply. Now, these rules on not talking to all these women and that, or this point of that, these rules don't apply here to the wives of actors, singers, nor of those who live on the intrigues of their own wives. For such men send their wives to others, or concealing themselves allow them to hold criminal intercourse. So in other words, basically those who are married to prostitutes, it doesn't matter if anybody else talks to them. Because that's what they are. So it's not a rule there. But still, even if they're talking to them privately, then the next verse says, yet he who secretly converses with such women, or with female servants kept by another master, and with female ascetics, shall be compelled to pay a small fine. You know, just something. Because they're loose women anyway, so therefore it's not a big deal that anyone talks to them. Like that. Does that make any sense? But for anybody who is, you know, properly situated, then these things are very strict. It'll be seen because the village is there. But these are considerations of the king, because only the king is dealing with this. So in other words, who's the authority? This is how he would deal with it. But at the same time, these are the standards by which people understand what's right and what's wrong. Like that. Does that make sense? But the one who deals with it will be some higher authority on this level. Like that. But on the level of where someone says, don't talk with my wife, or others say, we don't want to see you talking with this, that can be done on the local level. Right? The husband himself, family members, friends, relatives, anybody, they can take care of that. But actual fining or punishing the person, that has to be done by the king. It means the locals don't do that, take care of that themselves.
And it reminds me of I remember one lady, she was telling another lady that she doesn't want her to speak to her husband.
Mm-hmm.
Is that also like, it's only for ladies?
No, it would go both ways. The main principle is this: if it's seen that others feel that this lady is loose, she has some kind of a history or a reputation, and they don't want them talking to the husband, then they have the right to say that.
But to that lady, but not their husband, right?
No, you tell, the women would tell the ladies. If it's the men would tell the man.
The wife, she wouldn't tell her husband that you shouldn't be speaking to another lady, but she can approach the lady?
She could say she's uncomfortable with it if she feels it's there. Main thing is what works. Mm-hmm. You know, what works. Does that make some sense? Because mm-hmm. it shouldn't backfire. It shouldn't make things worse or create all kinds of politics or doubts. In other words, on this, as we see, it goes both ways. It's very strict about it. But at the same time, it's very fair. It means if someone has some actual proper reason, then it should not be considered badly. One shouldn't doubt. But if it doesn't have, then that doubt is there. And if there is, because of that, therefore some doubt, if they're told not to talk, then that should be respected. Now, if they talk and it's above board and it's fine, but just someone's jealous, that's not really proper. But at the same time, it is their family. So then others should just be careful and stay away. Why create trouble? Does that make some sense? So it gets... The main point is to understand that you don't want to create anything that could lead to disaster. That's the main principle. Does that make some sense? Yeah. Because you don't want to end up with improper children. That's the main thing. Because then they just create problems in the society. So then goes through some things just on punishments. He who violates an unwilling maiden shall instantly suffer corporal punishment. But a man who enjoys a willing maiden shall not suffer corporal punishment. If the nature be the same. In other words, they're from the same varna. Like that. It means there'll be a fine, but there won't be corporal punishment.
What's corporal punishment?
It would be, you know, like flogging or other things like that. Like that. Can be worse, but generally for us, we don't get into that much detail, you know, as devotees. But if you deal with non-devotees, then it can get pretty wild. It can be from losing the offending appendage to death, you know what I'm saying? It can get wild, you know, because it all depends upon what was done, right? You know, if he touches her in the wrong place, then he can lose some fingers. You know, it's just like this. That's the thing. It just that depends on what was done.
They have a nice one in the village.
Really? What's that?
The girl gets to draw a line walking backwards with her big toe. And as far as she draws, the boy has to rub his nose in the line.
Oh.
In the dirt.
Yeah, it can get a little annoying after a while. But if it's done right, is he can't put his knees on the ground, I think. Yeah, I kind of remember that because that adds to it. Because they sometimes do that, not on that, but as punishment. It's a village punishment. They put a peanut on the ground, and you have to push it with your nose.
Without your knees on the ground.
Yeah, so you have your hands on the ground and your feet on the ground. So it really starts to hurt your legs and stuff after a while. But if you have the nose on the ground, then it starts to... It's not so great for the first layer of skin on the nose. So. But you know, but the point is generally with devotees, then the physical aspect is not there, because what's applied, we'll see at the end of all this, then the principle is there that the Brahmins are never corporal punished. Their property's not taken, can be banished. Like that. So they're dealt with strongly, but they're not. They can be fined also sometimes. But they won't be corporally banished. All it is some of these are left here just so we get a little bit of an idea that, you know, just how seriously it should be taken.
Is that because there's a sin of bringing injury to a Brahmin?
Yeah, because Brahmins are never corporally punished like that. Okay. Now that was the equal. Right, now we start to get into if there's difference. For a maiden who makes advances to a man of high caste, he shall not take any fine. But her who courts a man of low caste, let him force to live confined in her house. Because if it's of a higher caste, then she can come up, so you may not get as much of a bad mix of a child. But if she goes down, then guaranteed any child they have is less than second rate. A Brahmin with a Shudra, you'll get a Chandala, you know, Kshatriya, it means all these, you get all these wild, wild stuff. So they're just, every one of them's bad. There's not ones that are kind of okay. Each one is bad. So therefore, then she would be confined to her house. Because that's always very, means her apartments. Means wherever she lives, she's got her room, she's got her bathroom, she has to stay there. She can't go out. She can't go out, see people, meet people. Anything like that. So that's very severe for the women. And then in some cases, I don't think we've mentioned here, if it's more severe, then all their stuff could be taken away. Like that. Men won't sell it or use it, but it's just taken away. She loses all her ornaments, all of this, all of that, and then she gets to stay in her apartments with, you know, nothing in there. You know, then it makes it even worse. So then that is mentioned as how they would be dealt with. And only in very severe cases, we'll see, it's coming down here at the bottom, that if she is very, how do you say, impetuous, she's very proud, she's from a big family, very influential family, she's extremely attractive, and she doesn't care, like that, she's not at all annoyed by this thing because she figures she'll, you know, her family will support her, you can't punish me. Then it mentions only, and that's the only case in the whole of Manu that it says she can be killed. There's no other thing that a woman does that she can be killed for, like that, because generally they're never punished corporally. But this is the one thing, and here it mentions, if a wife, proud of her greatness of her relatives or her own excellence, violates the duty which she owes to her lord, the king shall cause her to be devoured by dogs in a public place frequented by many. Like that, just to get the point across. Like that. But it's interesting, in Manu, in the whole thing, this is the only one instance where there's any punishment like this for women, of this severity. It's also, if the one previous to this. Like that. We'll read down to it. But if a damsel who pollutes another damsel shall be fined. Like that. It also mentions that they can get 10 lashes with the rod. But a woman who pollutes a damsel shall instantly shave her head, have her head shaved, and be made to ride through the town on a donkey. Like that. So that would be what it would apply there. So that one also, the woman can lose some fingers like that. But we left that part out. A man of low caste who makes love to a maiden of the highest caste shall suffer corporal punishment. A man of equal caste who defiles a willing maiden shall pay a fine in order to deter him from a repetition of the offense. Right? So he won't get corporal punishment. It means if the castes aren't the same, there'll be corporal punishment. But if they are the same, then there'll be a fine. You know, something must be there to cause a deterrent. Because then you get a worse child. If they're equal nature, at least they'll have a low grade of that nature. It's within the Varnashram system, but of low grade. But if it's of mixed caste, then it falls outside of the Varnashram system.
It
means, in any case, maybe they didn't get a child today, but tomorrow they might. Right? It means illicit activity doesn't really pay attention to that. You know, so that's the one principle. You know, plus then you start mixing up the attractions between the varnas, because it's a normal thing. Is you marry within your own nature. You don't marry something else, right? It's just like this. Okay, now you have a situation where you have cultured girls. They shouldn't be approached by low class boys, right? Because the low class boys would marry their own kind. Right? But nowadays, you see, is the low-class boys, they feel that they can approach. Right? So they'll come and bother. So immediately. I mean, it's just like this. Okay, now, your main Hindi cinema heroines are from which varna? Yeah. Your top ones are Brahmins. And your top heroes are from which varna? They're Muslims. That means outside the Varnashram. So what are you going to get? You get the worst possible child that you could get. So now, from this, you see the street kids, Indian kids, they think they can approach any lady. You understand? So therefore, it just breaks down the whole system. Well, normally, if you go back, you know, some years, you didn't have this. And so therefore, the common boy would, you know, he would expect he's marrying a common girl. And now they think, oh, I can get this one, I can get that one. You know what I'm saying? Or they think, okay, I'm going to marry a common girl, but I can have some fun with that one at least. So then you lose the whole cultural fabric by all these things. So the whole idea is that the culture should be peaceful because its purpose is not sense gratification. Its purpose is God consciousness. But you see the modern culture, it's just sense gratification. You see our own girls, how do they walk around here? Tight pants, you know, the chest hanging out, the hair hanging out. That's our own girls. So what does that mean? That means for them, they think attracting boys and having some interaction with them is important for them. It's a very major goal of happiness to them. If they can spend time like that, then now their goal will be met. So there's no Krishna consciousness. There's no social consciousness. Right? There's just no knowledge of any of this. It's just simply to have fun. So that means there's no meaning. It means sex is given no meaning. It's just something, it's a game. So then how demeaning? You know what I'm saying? You know, something is supposed to create the one of the deepest emotional experiences between a husband and wife, you know, for the performances of their duty. Now it's just some fun or some exercise. So that's bad. That means conjugal ras can never be tasted. Because the sex doesn't make the conjugal ras. The conjugal mood then mixed with that can create. You know what I'm saying? If there's a duty to perform, then that's emotional. Otherwise, this is just sensual. So that means they never taste conjugal rasa. And because of this, then they drive everyone nuts. Because they don't taste it, and they feel they're supposed to taste it, then they go on and on and on and on. And it wasn't this boy, this one, that one. You know, maybe I'm not showing enough. Maybe this is the... You know what I'm saying? It just goes, gets worse and worse and worse, and then other girls get influenced, the boys get influenced, the whole thing goes. You know, and simply because they don't know what they're doing. What they want to taste is not tasted out on the street. You know, what can you get out on the street? Right? Your highest grade restaurants are right there on the sidewalk. No. Your highest, best shops where you can buy the most valuable things are right there on the sidewalk. No. That's the point. So that means they're taking something that's supposed to have some value and meaning and dropping it down to just a street commodity. Right? Does that make some sense? It means the girl gives herself to the man. So that takes trust. Right? So, but if she's available, that you could see her walking down the street, you've never seen her in your life, but you can see whatever you want, then what's that mean? So that means there'll be no particular trust in the husband. Does that make some sense? So there's nothing special. The girl's beauty has no specialness to it. It doesn't have any special, no meaning. Because it's available to anybody. Does that make some sense? So the whole concept of emotion, you know, the girl is looking for emotion, but she doesn't know how to get it. She doesn't know how to deal with it. So she drops the emotional platform down to the sensual, and sensual is very, doesn't give any returns, really. You know what I'm saying? Right? You can cook for hours or days in preparation for something with all good emotional feeling. But when everybody sits down and eats what you've done for days, how long can they eat? Right? 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 10 minutes. So that's the whole point. And many years later, you don't remember the taste, but you can remember the emotions that were happening at that program. So that's the point. So what's happened is something that normally would be in on the emotional platform is dropped down to the sensuals. That means it's only worth a few minutes. And it's not something you can fall back on. You know what I'm saying? That's the point. They can't fall back on that relationship with that boy because it's based on sense gratification. It's not based on emotion. Because the boy is not attracted to them because of their nice mood. He's attracted by what they show or their availability. So you're not dealing on any any level of any importance. Does that make sense? So that's why in the Vedic culture it's just considered so bad, because in the Vedic culture rasa is held to be the most important, and of rasa, transcendental. So the idea is you control the lower ones and get to the higher, because rasa must be taste. So when you drop it down to the sensual platform, that is your platform of rasa that you're gaining, then that means you'll constantly be absorbed in how to gain that sensual rasa. So that's all your planning, your endeavor, your, so you're not even going to be aware of the emotional, let alone the spiritual. So like that. Plus they're frustrated, because they're frustrated, they make everyone else's life miserable. Like that, they always will do that. You'll see those common girls are the ones that make the most trouble for everyone else. And the girls that are happy, situated, nicely working, they make trouble for nobody. You never hear about them. Like that. So that's the principle. So that's why there's so much put on this. Okay, so then we mentioned about that proud wife who will be devoured by dogs, and it says, let him cause the male offender to be burnt on a red hot iron bed. They shall put logs under it until the sinner is burnt to death. Like that. So I think that would also probably be public. Like that. So he gets the bed, she gets the dogs. I guess that's about what they would be getting, right? The adulteress would be consorting with the dog, and the guy would get the bed, right? So then she gets the dogs and he gets the hot bed. Okay. On a man once convicted who is again accused within a year, a double fine must be inflicted. Even thus must the fine be doubled for repeated intercourse with a vratya and a chandali. Vratya, then there's many definitions. The main definition of a vratya means a woman who's barren. So then, because there's no purpose. So that would either be a girl who's too young, or a girl who is not married, or it would be a woman who is cannot have children, or it would mean a woman who is too old to have children. So any of those cases, that would be a vratya. And a chandali just means low-class woman, who's outside of the varnashram system. Like that. So anything with that, then it would be doubled. Or if he's been accused before and within a year again, it's doubled. And if again accused, then double of that. It would just keep, you just keep adding it up. In other words, you're trying to some way get through to the person. If it's not, strong enough that there needs to be corporal punishment. So if it's only the level that would be fines. So now it goes into the point on the Brahman. Why the Brahmins are left out of corporal punishment. Though in here is the fines on Brahmins for mixed matches is higher than for others. Like that. Because they know more. So that for them to deal in the mixed, then they're fined heavier than the others are fined. Tonsure of the head is ordained for a Brahmin instead of capital punishment. But men of other castes he shall suffer corporal punishment. Capital punishment. Oh, okay, this is capital. So then, in other words, this is the one based on that how Arjuna solved the problem that Draupadi wanted and Bhima and Krishna wanted Ashwatthama killed, but Yudhishthira didn't. So he had to simultaneously kill Ashwatthama, but not kill him. So this is the Varnashram. I mean, this is the Dharmashastra rule that for Brahmins, when they would suffer, it would be capital or corporal punishment. Then instead of that, they're shaved. Like that. So he had his hair and he had that jewel that he was born with. So then that was cut. So then for him, then that was, you know, equivalent to death, because then people know. Right? Does that make some sense? Let him never slay a Brahmin, so this is to the kings, let him never slay a Brahmin, though he have committed all possible crimes. Let him banish such an offender, leaving all his property to him and his body unhurt. No greater crime is known on earth than slaying a Brahmana. The king, therefore, must not even conceive in his mind the thought of killing a brahmana. Because in the other ages, what you think, you get the reaction for. So even he shouldn't think of killing him. Because in the other ages, then you'll get the reaction for having killed a brahmana. This age is not good, because by cultivating you pollute the conscious. By polluted consciousness, then you may do worse and worse things. So in either case, it's not to be indulged in. So then the conclusion of this section. The king in whose town lives no thief, no adulterer, no defamer, no man guilty of violence, and no committer of assaults, attains the world of Indra. The suppression of those five in his dominions secures to a king paramount sovereignty among his peers and fame in this world. Like that. So if the king can keep those out of his kingdom, then people will be know him as a good king. Okay, then some miscellaneous rules. Neither a mother, nor father, nor wife, nor son shall be cast off. He who casts them off, unless guilty of a crime causing loss of caste, shall be fined 600 panas. Right, so just because you don't like them, you can't dump them. Right? The duty is there, that duty must be maintained. So unless there's a crime that drops them out of their varna, then it can't, they can't be cast off. A wife, a son, and a shudra, these three are declared to have no property. The wealth which they earn is acquired for him to whom they belong. So this means that there's two different things here. So then the gifts that a woman receives, you know, from her family at the time of marriage, from the husbands, from other relatives, these are her property. These are the property of women. But here it's talking about if a wife does something that generates money, then that money goes to whoever she's under the protection of. If it's her father, the money goes to the father. If it's the husband, it goes to the husband. And if it's the son, it goes to the son. But her own personal things that have been gifts to her, those are hers. Like that. This means, so that's what it means. The wealth which they earn, right? Then that is referring to that. But we'll see in the next section is that the money that's earned in the house, the husband's money, that is managed by the wife. She takes the money, she collects it, she expends it, she saves it. All that is done by her. So she still runs it, whatever it is, but it's considered the husband's or father's or son's. That would be the principle, yes. Because it's one of the ways she can be engaged. Because generally she's the one that's very interested in it and wants to have a say in everything, how it's dealt with and how it should be expended and what's the best way. And she's the one that's worried for emergencies and that. So therefore, if she manages it, then it will be put into that situation. So if something goes wrong, there's not enough money in an emergency, she hasn't put it away, then there's no one to blame but herself. Otherwise, then the whole world will get blamed. Husband will be blamed, everyone else will be blamed, Krishna's having the whole, but if she did it, then it's harder to blame, you know, because they like dealing with the money. You know, it's a natural thing, because that's what they gain in safety. So if they have our control of it, then they feel the gain that's there is safe. So it's just, it's a natural way to engage them.
So it's the duty of the husband to give the action to help.
Yeah, it means what is money for spending, like that. But that money which is there in emergency on his side means 50% is given away in charity. So that would be managed by the wife. 25% is for maintenance of the family. That the wife would deal with. That other 25%, he may give it to her, she may put it away, or he may not give it, he may. You know, that's another thing. But that part of it he doesn't have to deal with. She doesn't even have to know about it. He's not obliged to tell her if it's there. Like that. Because if it's there, she may think of plans for it. Oh, we could buy this, that, then it won't be emergency money. So he's put it away if there's something very serious. But she has to be putting away from the daily expenses for little things that come up. You know, you break something, I mean, what do you call it? One of those expenses. You have it, nothing. It's like petty cash, but it's a name of a particular kind of expense. It's not a normal expense. You know, it's not a planned expense, but it comes up just because the modes of nature exist. Does that make sense? It's just like you never have to deal with something, but it just comes up like that. So those expenses are, you know, basic medical, this, that, just out of, you have to buy extra this or some extra guests come or all these things. That's the kind of money the wife has to be putting away. It's for something even bigger or more major. That's what the husband may or may not put away. It's recommended, Rupa Goswami mentions, that that's the best way it's done. But you can put that two ways, you know, like that. That's the thing. 50% is given away, but the other 50% means you can take, well, part is for you, part is for emergencies. So for you can mean yourself, or it can mean the whole family. So depending upon how you deal with it. But the basic principle is you give away 50% of what you earn if you're generating money. And you live off of one quarter. So that's how you decide on your lifestyle. Is one can generate this much or receive whatever it is. This is how much money you'll have. So then you figure, okay, one quarter of that is what we'll use as maintenance. 50% we'll give in charity. And the other 25% will be put away for emergency. Does that make sense? Because if you accept that, it really changes how you look at money. Because otherwise you get a certain amount of money, you think, wow, I can do all this with it. And there's no space for charity or other things or like that. If you look at it, I only have one quarter to deal with. So you get $100, I only have 25 to spend. And the other 75 is put away. It completely changes how you think about money. So suddenly all of your plans for the future all change. Like that.
In Mahabharata, Draupadi says that actually she's the only one that knows how much it all came in.
Oh yeah.
And that she manages.
Well, that would be a nice thing to read.
Should I get it?
Yeah. Go ahead and get that. Yeah, it's a point where she's approached by Satyabhama. And Satyabhama then asks Draupadi, says, you have 5 husbands and they're all, you know, nicely domesticated. How do you do it? I have trouble keeping one, you know, in line, but you're keeping 5 in line, so what's your trick? So then she goes through and mentions all the things what she does. Right? So first Satyabhama puts forward, you know, do you have some mantras you're chanting, you know, or some incant, you know, some other tantra that you're doing, or, you know, are you just doing it through your, you know, physical beauty and charms, or like that. So Draupadi gets very insulted at that. He says, that's all for low-class women. Like that. Says, cultured women, we have a different method where we keep the men in line. And she mentions that as one of the things is that she collects the wealth. Like that. Means is that there is the, how you say, so much comes in that's there, but what is their personal wealth? That she takes care of. So even the Pandavas themselves don't really know what all the money they have. Only she knows. And then many times you see, like in joint families, then it's whoever's the senior woman in the family. You know, it's like, let's say you have the grandmother. You know, because all the boys will stay in their house, the girls will come to the boys' house. So then the mother of those sons, they all work, if they're running a joint thing, they all work, and whatever they get, they turn over to the mother. Or if the grandmother's there, it'll be the grandmother. She manages the money in the house. So none of the other brothers know how much the other one makes. And so she runs everything. And then even if sometimes there's a problem where... Thank you. Sometimes there's a problem, let's say one of the brothers loses his job. None of the other brothers will know. So he may take him a few months. So he goes out every day, looks for a job. But he comes back and everything goes on normal. So only the grandmother or whoever's there knows that he's not bringing in any money. But she's put money aside, so it all works out. So like this, these are the old traditions like that. Okay. Well, the Pandavas and the Brahmanas were listening to Markandeya Rishi. This is when they're still in the forest, like that. I think they're in the I think they're in their last year before the incognito, like that. So they spent. So this is the 12th year, because the 13th year they have to spend incognito. And so Arjuna's already come back, and then Krishna and has come to visit, and he's come with Satyabhama. While the Pandavas and the Brahmanas were listening to Markandeya Rishi, Draupadi and Satyabhama entered the cottage and began to converse with great pleasure. In the course of the conversation, Satyabhama inquired, "Princess of Panchala, how is it that you are able to keep your husband so submissive and obedient to you? I see that the Pandavas are always ready to please you in all respects, and they never become even slightly angry with you. Do you control them by some mystic incantation? Or is this the good result of all the austerities you had formerly performed? Or is it just by your youthful beauty and the artistic use of dress and cosmetics that you manage to keep your husbands under your sway? I am asking you this because I desire to keep my dear Lord Krishna under control in just the same way. Please tell me your secret." Because the problem is Krishna is so independent, they never can really get him under full control. Draupadi felt a little offended by Satyabhama's words. So with a bit of indignation, she replied, "O queen, these are the methods of wicked women. You should know that men can never be made truly obedient by such means, by these other mundane means. My secret is simply this. I give up all sense of false pride, as well as personal desires for sense gratification. I carefully control my anger, and I always serve my husbands with great care and devotion. Indeed, I restrain my senses so carefully that I do not even allow a glance to betray the slightest bit of emotion." So she's upset or that, then she doesn't allow them to understand it at all. Right? You don't have this thing as like someone was telling me the other day, is, you know, the husband is telling that he comes home, right? And then all the kids are quiet and everyone's tiptoeing around. He says, you know, and it's like, and they all go, you know, so then he's also tiptoeing around the house, you know, and then she's, "Why are you tiptoeing around the house? Why are everyone so quiet? No, we just didn't want to upset you." "What do you mean I'm not upset?" Like that. So Draupadi says that she doesn't do that. Yeah.
"Sorry, I got halfway through one sentence and all I got was, I give up all sense of," and what was the end of the sentence?
"I give up all sense of false pride, as well as personal desires for sense gratification." You got all that one? You get that one, false pride. Because if these aren't there, the false pride's not there, the desire for sense gratification, then the sense of duty is the strength. So if that sense of duty is there, that will automatically draw that from the husband. Because that's what she's talking about when she says here that... I see that the Pandavas are always ready to please you in all respects, and they never become even slightly angry with you. So that means they're always trying to please, and they're very kind. So that's the duty. Prabhupada mentions that there are two things the girl should be trained in, two things the boy should be trained in. The girl should be trained in chastity and how to be satisfied with anything that the husband provides. And the boy should be trained in brahmacharya and how to be sensitive to the needs of women. If those two are, if those qualities are there in both, then the marriage will work. So here Draupadi is saying that point. She's no false pride and no interest in sense gratification. Therefore, she'll be satisfied with whatever they give. And because of this, then they're always trying to please her. That's the principle. If you don't want, somebody's always trying to give you. If you always want, no one wants to give you. Like that. So that's the principle. So she's understanding it. She's saying, this is what the, you know, how the culture. Yeah. "I can never think of bathing, eating, or sleeping until my husbands and servants have done so. And I am ready to rise up quickly at any hour to personally greet my husbands when they return home." So in other words, she will rest. If they're late or something, she'll rest. But, you know, not the whole arrangement. So then when they come to get up, see, interact, whatever it is, then go to bed. Like that. So she's able to do like this. "I always endeavor to do just what is to do, just that which is agreeable to them. And I discharge my various duties cheerfully and without lethargy. I always serve my superiors, and I never speak of them disrespectfully, because the superiors, especially in the house, are the husband's relatives, right? The husband's father, the husband's mother, the husband's, like that. So if you speak disrespectfully to them, then the husband will not be happy, because it's his, you know, the mother, his mother is dear to him. Most of all, oh yeah, of all of them. Here's the next one. Most of all, I am very careful to always wait upon my mother-in-law, Kunti, with the utmost respect and attention. So, previously that was there, so then in the marriage, you don't marry someone who you're not going to like the relatives. Right? So, in the plan of the marriage arrangement, you have to look at what relatives you'll be dealing with, especially the senior ones. So this modern thing is, you know, the mother-in-law, you know, it's always the terror of the whole arrangement. But the point is you don't marry somebody who you don't like their mother. Right? If you don't get along with their mother, why marry them? Because the mother comes with a deal. You know? Because she is naturally attached to their son or daughter. She's going to be very attached to the grandchildren. There's going to be interaction. It is a family. So that's a consideration. You see that. And then it's a complete... So here she's saying is that, you know, she's always respectful to all the seniors, but especially to the mother-in-law. Because in the house, as we mentioned before, they're the ones that run the place. Like that. Because in the house, the men have the women manage it. They manage what's outside the house. So that way then it works, yes.
It's an interesting contradiction that in Western culture, the joke goes the other way. Boy who has difficulty with mother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
They say, don't marry someone if you don't like his mother.
Uh-huh. Yeah. No, it's all... That's the thing, is you see everything gets turned around. Like that. But at the same time, you always hear the girl can't handle the boy's mother either, because she's always expecting her to be of the same standard that she is affection and perfection and everything, and drives her nuts. But in here, if it's just accepted that one person's liked, and then two is just, you know, she knows how to best please, right? That's what the son is used to, is how his mother dealt. So then she just has to learn that, and then you have the same standard. So there's no contradiction. So it's easy on that side, actually, because there's no contradiction, because it's the same person you have to please. You know, like that. So that makes it quite easy. So that's probably why that's the one that's not mentioned as much, because they have a common purpose. But the girl's mother, then the boy doesn't actually technically have to please her, you know, because she leaves that family and becomes the other family. So then it's not as much there. But, you know, but at the same time, is, you know, dealings are there, because the girl will go back to, when she has the children, she'll go back to the father's house. Or there's any inconvenience, she'll go back to the father's house, like Damayanti. When this whole thing came, then she goes back to the father's house. She sends her children back to the father's house. Like that. When she's going to the forest, she sends her children there. Just like when the Pandavas go to the forest, then Subhadra's son and goes back to Dwarka. Like that. Subhadra and her son go to Dwarka. She doesn't go to the forest with them. Like that. Because for performance of religious duty, only the first wife has to be there. So the Pandavas, their sacrifices and that in the forest will all be done with Draupadi, because she is the first wife. All the other queens then are secondary after that. So they're not obliged to be involved in the sacrifices. So then she doesn't need to go to the forest. So she goes back to Dwarka with her father. Like that. And then after they come back, then she comes back to there.
While residing at Indraprastha, Maharaj Yudhishthira, now here's where you find out about her management. Maharaj Yudhishthira used to feed thousands of Brahmins daily, and it was my duty to see that their needs were properly taken care of. I had 100,000 maidservants to assist me, and I knew the names, faces, and capabilities of each and every one of them. I used to direct all of these maidservants, and any complaints about them would be submitted personally to me. In other words, if a maidservant wasn't behaving properly, it didn't go to Yudhishthira or anyone else, it went to her, and she dealt with it. Besides these maidservants, I also knew all of the male servants and even the cowherds. Because cowherds, you have to get milk and stuff from them and needs for the house, cow dung, this, that. And the male servants, then they also do so many things in the palace. Like that. Though they may not be under her direction, but she still knows them because she has to interact with them. In fact, it was I alone who kept track of my husband's daily income and expenditure, and thus only I knew the totality of their wealth. My dear Satyabhama, it is because I took on this great burden of responsibility and was thus the first to rise up in the morning and the last one in bed at night that I have won the great respect of my husband's. So it's a matter of respect. So because of respect, then they want to please her in all ways. Satyabhama then said, Draupadi, please forgive me for even suggesting that you might have controlled your husbands by some duplicitous method. Draupadi continued, my dear queen, a woman can captivate the mind of her husband, thus drawing it away from anyone else, in a way that is devoid of deceit. To do so, a wife must first of all consider her husband to be her lord. After all, it is he alone who can fulfill all her desire for children, clothing, and all other things for a comfortable and enjoyable life. By always adoring her husband and promptly serving him with whatever he requires, a wife makes him feel that she really loves him. When her husband orders a maidservant to do something, a wife should do it instead. I mean, he may have told the maidservant, get that. The mother, queen knows about it. So then she will do it herself rather than have the maidservant do it. Whatever a man says to his wife in confidence should never be repeated to others. If a man hears someone else repeat what he has said confidentially told his wife, then he certainly becomes irritated. A woman should consider all persons who are hostile towards her husband to be persona non grata. And I was telling, one man was telling me about how, who he had difficulties with and problems with, then he would find that the girl he was with, then she would many times take pleasure in talking with them more freely and openly. Like that. And so that would annoy him greatly. So here he's saying is, you know, who's an enemy of the husband, then she doesn't deal with. Like that. And who's his friends and relatives, then she also then supports. So then there's a common mood and common method between husband and wife. And then someone was mentioning that that in the Indian families, like you may have 50 people in that family, that hot circle, and if any one of them has been insulted by somebody, the whole family won't deal with that person. Even though it had nothing to do with them. Like that. So it makes it very strong that someone knows don't mess with somebody because it's not just them. You have a whole family you're going to insult. So then it reduces very greatly how people, I mean, it reduces greatly in insensitive dealings between members of the community because they know it's much more than one person getting upset. You'll upset a whole family. So they're very, very careful like that. Does that make sense? So all these things are there just to create proper interaction and proper dealings between the members of the society. Right? Like that. So that's the whole purpose, because the ultimate thing is we want to get to the platform of that affection for Krishna, that interaction with Krishna and his devotees. So that's a major thing. Like I've seen sometimes devotees, they don't like other devotees. They don't like being in the association of devotees. They find it's a problem. But they say they want to be with Krishna. But when you get with Krishna, he's with unlimited devotees, especially Krishna. Maybe Vishnu, maybe less. But that's one of the special qualities of Krishna. He's always surrounded by loving devotees. Always. There's no time when he's alone. Like that. You may find Vishnu alone, seemingly. But you don't find Krishna alone. You never see him alone. So then it's a problem. If you don't like others, don't like associating with others, don't like interacting with others, then you won't like being with Krishna because he's with tons of devotees. So that's why this principle of proper interaction and etiquette is always so much emphasized, because the Lord is always with devotees that you have to interact nicely with. So if the principle is accepted, then it works for you. But if the principle is ignored, then it will actually have repercussions on one's spiritual
development. So ultimately, that's the maybe the hidden meaning or the indirect meaning to all the verses. Does that make some sense? So directly, these verses are making a statement regarding the Dharma Shastra. But indirectly, they'll be pointing to some more esoteric or philosophical and their hidden meanings also. Does that make sense? You know, like we took that one verse, that wife should still, you know, deal properly with a husband who's badly behaved. Right? So that's the direct meaning. Right? Indirect, we see, is that by doing that, she's following her duty, she's virtuous and all that, she'll be elevated even if the guy's not. So she'll make advancement despite him. But then that hidden meaning was, is this is the mood of the gopis. That Krishna, no matter what he does, we're surrendered. Right? Does that make some sense? So that's why all these things, they're interchangeable. It's just a matter of how deep one can understand it. That's the whole thing. Because it's just one subject matter. So you could take any of the Vedic literatures and from it describe any other Vedic literature or any level of understanding. From Karmakanda, Jnanakanda to Bhakti. That's the beauty of it. If one understands the principles underlying it, then one can see that it's only one topic, and it's actually Krishna. It's just a matter of, because Krishna's come in and expanded into the material creation, so Krishna in the form of the building. Then there's rules how you deal with Krishna. Like, there's rules of how to deal with Krishna in the form of a deity. You have the rules of Pancharatra. Krishna in the form of buildings and land, that's the Silpa Shastras, you know, the Vastu and all those things. Krishna in his form of how he's all the planetary systems, right? Like you see that Krishna is, you know, Patala is his feet and the oceans are his waist and the sun and moon are his eyes and all these different, it tells all the planetary systems. I think, you know, Vital is angle, one Atal is knee, it mentions all these different. So in that form, then you have the Jyotish Shastras. Like that. Krishna in the form of language, you have the grammar. Does that make some sense? So it's actually all you're describing is Krishna. So that's why from one you can go into the other and you can see it from deeper and more, you know, how you say, observable platforms. Does that make some sense? Okay.
She should never allow herself to be seen enjoying the company of other men, even to the extent of speaking privately with her own sons. Means that she can speak privately, but she shouldn't be manifesting a, how you say, complete interaction, absorption with that, dealing with the sons, that it leaves out the husband if he's also on the scene. Does that make sense? If it's only the mother and the son and the husband's not there, then she'll act as much as openly and as enthusiastically as she likes. But if the husband's there, then it's husband and wife as parents and this is their son. So she shouldn't be dealing with the son, just that it's her son and leaving the husband out of the picture. Does that make some sense? Like that. Because then it's, how does he fit in? Because it's his son, but then the wife is dealing so strong. It's his wife, but she's dealing with the son. So he doesn't know how to fit into it. So then it has to be that when he's present, then the wife always includes him in the picture, or at least considers that maybe the interaction is there. It would be interaction that would be suitable for his presence. Does that make some sense? Like that. So she's just mentioning these subtleties, because it's all these subtleties that actually kind of, how you say, strain the relationship. It's generally not the gross things. There may be some gross, but it's, you add up a lot of subtleties and that'll put more strain. You know, because the gross one's easier to deal with. The other ones, especially if you don't know these principles, then you can't voice what it is. The husband doesn't like something. He can't say what. He doesn't know. And the wife can't understand what it is either. So then there's a feeling of
dissatisfaction or lack of trust or something is there, but they can't put their finger on it. So the idea of the Vedic is all the things should be known and practiced, so then therefore you know what it is, and therefore you avoid it. So it makes it very, very clear. So then, so the communications then can be very, very open between husband and wife. So even if she's doing this, if she knows it but maybe forgot about it, the husband knows it, then he can point it out, you know, what it is, or she can be aware of it. Does that make some sense? Like that?
Yeah.
Is there some description regarding man's duties like that?
Yeah. But it's just I didn't bring it up at this time. It means when we go through the Lagu, then you'll find most of them are the men's duties or common duties between husband and wife. But these were specific things that we're going through. It just was from the women's vantage point, you know.
I'm asking because for me it's also important what expectation can I have.
I mean, the basic one is that one that I mentioned before, is that whatever the husband can provide, one is satisfied. Because he has a nature, so whatever he can do, that's all he can do. But if you're dealing with him very nicely, then he's going to do his best. Like that. So that's the whole thing. The wife doesn't have to try to get him to do his duty best. She, by doing hers properly, he'll be inspired to do his the best. And then whatever is that best, you know, or whatever is the endeavor, then she's satisfied. And by that, then he'll be more inspired. Because if you can do something for someone and they're satisfied, you want to do more. But if you do something for someone and they're not satisfied, you may try a little harder this way and that way. If you can never satisfy them, you give up. You know? Like that. I've seen that myself, you know, here in the community. Husband just decides, that's it, I can't do it. You know? And so then it just doesn't work. So that principle, that's why that's taken as essential, is chastity and that principle of satisfaction. Like that Manu also, in Narad Muni, mentions some seventh canto, when he's describing the four varnas and all that. Then after that he describes the duties of the women. What is chastity? Like that. And then he also, the interaction of the men with them. So the men will naturally, like this, it says here, this one. I see the Pandavas are always ready to please you in all respects, and they never become even slightly angry with you. So that's their duty. But that duty is based on the wife doing her duty. Like that. If the wife doesn't do hers, then one can't expect this from them. Like that. So if you have any specifics, then we can try to address it. But if it's generic, it's quite big. But the main thing is that the man is sensitive to the feminine needs. But that means he needs to know what they are. Like that. Because they can be quite bewildering to the men. So they basically have to know what are the areas in which they function. You know? Like that. But even if they don't, then if there's good communication, then the wife, at times when she feels it's proper to say, when she's in the mood, then she can mention. And then he should try his best to fulfill it. In other words, she can mention, and then he should try. He make an endeavor. Whatever he gets, she should be happy with. Like that. Because one can never fulfill the feminine needs. That's the principle. So it's not just for the family, but it's for the individual. Because a woman's mind is very quick, and it can expand so quickly that the desires that the woman can dream up can never be fulfilled by anyone. Like that. So that's why satisfaction is the main principle in their happiness. It means it's there for everybody. But it's especially important for the women to practice that. Because then whatever they do have, if they're satisfied, they're happy. So even if they desire something more, but when they get whatever it is, they're satisfied with that, they're satisfied. So that process will always be going on. You know, but the satisfaction will be there. Does that make some sense? Because otherwise it can't be fulfilled. That's the thing that should be known. So women should know that. Therefore, they're satisfied. And the men should try their best to satisfy. Like that. So the only way it works is if the women are satisfied. Because otherwise, you can't. It means they'll be miserable, the women will be miserable. If the women are miserable, then the men are miserable. And if men are miserable, they don't work their best. Like that. So when the men are happy, that the women are happy, then they work their best. And if they could feel that they can do their best and the wife will be satisfied, then that best can always develop and increase. But if not, it'll just decrease. Does that make some sense? So that's a general kind of principle. Is that okay? So that means on all those levels, that would mean money, facilities, emotions, interactions. You know what I'm saying? I remember one couple was always talking. She was Oriental, but, you know, had grown up in the West. But her whole family was there, so you had the whole big joint family, you know. And he was Western, you know, grew up in that kind of environment. And so he used to like to spend time with, you know, at the temple and the friends and this and that. But she was used to, you know, a scene happening in the house. So she was always dissatisfied. He was never at the house. And he was never satisfied that why she's demanding that when, you know, we could be spending time at the temple. You know, he didn't mind taking her to the temple. But you do things there. But she wanted him always to be at the house. So then between this, then there's a problem. So if the wife, if she wants to marry that kind of guy, if she wanted someone who always at the house and would follow the same cultures, then she should have married a someone of equal nature. That's why it's there. And he should have been with a girl who is of equal nature. He can't complain. Why is she complaining? Because that's how she grew up. So he should marry someone who's grown up like he's grown up. Like that. And she should marry someone who grew up like she did. But if there is any difference, if she just accepted that's the way he is and that's the way he's going to interact and be happy with that, then she would have been happy rather than dissatisfied. Right? He's willing to put it, he can put in X amount of time, then she's not satisfied with that because she wants it to be more than that. So that means what little bit he does give, she doesn't get anything out of that either. So she's dissatisfied anyway. Right? Means he can give, let's say, 3 hours. She wants six. So she should be at least 3 hours satisfied. She should be 50% satisfied. But no, she's 100% dissatisfied. So at least that. And if she just says, okay, this is all the guy can do. This is all he can relate to. To him, that's being really emotional. Okay. So then she's happy with the 3 hours. So then she's satisfied. Does that make some sense? Because it's easier for the woman to adjust that than the man. Because the point is the man is the way he is and he does the things the way he is there. The woman has her nature, but she's trying to attain a particular emotional experience. Right? In other words, they're moving through different fields. The man performs an activity because it gives a result. Right? Through a logical progression. Woman does an activity because it gives an experience that she pleases her. Right? Therefore, the women don't understand the men's methods where it just moves through this logical, unsentimental thing. And the men don't understand the women because they'll move from one activity to the next, that the continuity is the emotion, but it doesn't seem to be logical progression in getting a particular mundane result out of. Does that make sense? So that means is whatever will get that emotional result, if you adjust to that and get it, it doesn't matter. For the women. But for the men, they stick to their method. If they're going to change, it's very slow to change them. You know, women can much more change things much more easily. So on that platform, they're smarter. And the men are duller. You know, they just have this is the way they do it, and they just do it that way. Because women think in that realm more. Therefore, they can adjust. They're like, okay, if we just do this and it works, what's the problem? Point is they want to be happy. So the men are happy with that methodicalness. and the women have what they're looking for to be happy. So if all it is adjust over to this and accept that, then the women are happy. Because to get the men to shift, very difficult. Very difficult. They can be sensitive to women's needs, but they generally won't change their method. Like that. Yes.
On the point of that, the proud and by punishment is so severe, is it connected with, because of one has a must, that purifying?
Yes, that would be one of the things. There would be that aspect. So that means this has come to only after the normal methods. She's already been chastised, she's already been restricted, her things have been taken away. This and she still doesn't care. So then the difficulty is here, it only mentions proud Adustus because of her high birth and beauty. It doesn't mention this for any other girl. Like that is specifically that, because that girl can move in the highest realms. So she can bring down top people. And those people are the leaders of society. So this is very dangerous. If she's a common woman like that, then she'll only bring down common men. You know what I'm saying? But if she has these qualities that can project her into the higher stratas of society that actually lead the society, that's very dangerous. Because you bring, like you see, he's American president, right? Common lady. Right? Just a common lady who works on the floor. Right? Her only claim to fame is she's got some frilly underwear that she'll pull out of the back of her skirt and show them off. Right? So, that's it. So, but because of that beauty and attraction, then she makes trouble for 265 million people. Just because she wants to be prominent. That's all. I don't think she really cared about the president. She just wanted to be in a prominent place. And that's just going by the beauty, not by her social strata. Now, if she was from a big family, that makes it even easier. Does that make some sense? So that's why that kind of woman is so dangerous and she's dealt with so severely. But that means all other methods would have been tried to correct her before, and still she is proud. Therefore, then you can see this girl's incorrigible and she may do anything and bring down anyone. So therefore, she has to be removed from the scene. You know, and then her removal is, you know, not overly pleasant, right? Like that. You know, it mentions a public place, and then everybody gets to see.
If someone is...
Yeah. It means next life they'll be pure. Next life they'll be pure. It mentions that in dealing with the thieves. Like that. They're completely pure after that. They might even be elevated to heavenly planets. I'm not sure. Do you remember? Does it say that? They're elevated, or it just means they're just clean?
They're liberated.
They're liberated. So that means they'll get to the heavenly planets. You know, it means not as demigods. They're just as wannabe. But they're completely purified. So if they've had the punishment, so it's completely clean. So then next life, they'll start off with you know, basically with better samskaras. They won't be held back by all these impurities that they would have. So that's why it's so important. You know, so only those who understand the full picture then can appreciate how it works like that. Is that okay?
I want to press because I cannot like understand it in my mind. The principle that wife knows more about the income and money than the husband, because I have the experience that money means power and how it helps to develop that like dependent consciousness when you know more about the most essential thing.
But at the same time is whose money is it? Right? So then it's a service. that's where the balance comes. That's why all these things are, have their balance, is that like the Kshatriyas run the country. They're the last word as authority, but they have to do so in consultation with Brahmins. So therefore, even though they have absolute power, they are controlled by the Brahmins. And the Brahmins have such power that they control the king, but they themselves don't do any of the management. You know what I'm saying? So you always have these two things like that. Because then the wife is kind of, otherwise they're always thinking they're not getting any money. Or he has more money. He's not telling her. Like that. No, here's all the money. So then she knows it all, so she's peaceful. It's a matter of trust also. Means you, this is being done with a wife who is trustworthy. So that means the wife has to prove that she's trustworthy. You know? Like that. So it goes both ways. There must be that surrender from the man's side, but then there has to be a surrender from the woman's side.
And if he needs some money to spend, he comes to her, or he has something for his own expenditure?
That the other money can be kept like that for him. He can keep money that he doesn't give her for that, if he feels that's important. Otherwise, the things in the house, the wife will always get. Right? The wife doesn't want to see the husband looking like a bum. Right? So she's already going to arrange that he gets this, that, gets him the clothes, this. See, they're always doing those things. Like that. But if there's something outside of that that he would need that doesn't really work in her world, then he may take that out before he gives her the money. You know? Things like that. So that has to be seen. It's not that he's asking her for money. He says she's the one that runs it for him. You know what I'm saying? So it has both the things. But in the house, and she's running it, but at the same time, she's running it, you know, in line with what is, pleases him. That's what she says. She doesn't do anything that would be displeasing to the husband. So how she would spend the money and run the house would be the way they would like it to be run. Right? But at the same time, is she does manage it. So there is sign of that control, but at the same time, that control then goes to a higher level of service to the next level. Right? It means the Vaishyas control the Shudras, but they are submissive to the kings in that they pay tax. Right? The kings are, you know, are in charge of the lower kings and the Vaishyas and all that, but they're submissive to the Brahmins. The Brahmins are in charge of that whole thing, but they're submissive to, you know, the higher Brahmins than them, their Acharyas. They're the same, but then they're to the so it always goes back. So your position of authority on one level is your service to the level above you. Does that make sense? So simultaneously, your need is taken care of. At the same time, that need is engaged in such a way that it's progressive for you. It's not regressive. You know, like this thing, absolute power corrupts absolutely. But the principle is in the Vedic, there is no such thing. Because everybody has somebody above them. But in their field, they are the authority and the controlling factor. But still, to make those decisions and do, they still have somebody above them. You know what I'm saying? So you have simultaneously are in charge of the field, but at the same time are submissive to those above you. So you don't get that combination generally so much in the Western thing. You know, you do the thing, you're in charge. On some levels, on practical levels, you see that. You have a board of directors. There's a CEO. CEO has full reign to do whatever he wants as long as what he does pleases the board of directors. They won't get in the way of his day-to-day management. Like that. But it still must be done in such a way that they're pleased. Because if they're not pleased, then it won't be good. Does that make some sense? So that principle you see working in that level. But you see in some others where it doesn't have to give results, and sometimes it doesn't always work like that. You know, like in sometimes governments and things, positions and their ministers and this and that, sometimes it gets a bit out of line. The guy has his field, but the guy above him won't let him work in his field. Right? But in the business world, it has to make money, so they don't do that. And the ones that do that don't make any money. You know? Does that make some sense? Yeah.
marriage, I just remember something talking about money in the train, like his wife was sleeping, and the husband was crying, was selling some peanuts. So the husband, I guess he wanted some peanuts, so he would look left and right, and then he wakes his wife up and says something. And then she's like so annoyed, and then she takes her purse and she gives the 5 rupees and buys the peanuts. So I was like going on looking at them, it was so cute. The guy tells me, it's because, you know, I always spend, I think it's better, my wife has all the money, so I don't need any money.
Yeah, because she'll generally, even though it's women will spend the most, in one sense, but on the other, they're the most careful about it. You know, if it's someone else's money, you'll see they're always spent. You know, but if it's their money, then they're very careful. So that way it also controls that. You know, I think I was talking about Narishwar and his devotees that he works with, that they do women's fashion. And I remember the lady, you know, who actually buys all this stuff and manages the business, basically, then she was making the comment, as you know, she was just like, you know, I would say, God bless, you know, women's desire to unlimitedly spend money. Because she says, every couple of months something new comes out and the girls come down there and buy, you know. And then there's some, and they were telling you that they'd be, somebody they haven't seen for a long time, she hasn't showed up for many months, and hey, what happened? He just says, I can't come to your shop. He says, everything you have, I just want to buy. And so I have to stay away, you know. So these kind of things, but if it's you're in control of the money, then you know that you have all these things to spend for it. Because the idea is a woman will spend for what she wants. So if she has the money for all of her whole field, then she's only going to spend what she needs in the particular things. Otherwise, she doesn't have for the rest of the field, then whatever money she gets, she'll spend just where she's dealing. Does that make some sense? You know, so like that. You know, so then they'll be careful, then they'll look at the bigger picture and then very carefully plan all the expenses. Like that. Does that make some sense? So it's just a very expert application of the nature. Like that. So I think that's it. Yeah, in this way Draupadi gave very good instructions and Satyabhama appreciated them greatly. At last Lord Krishna took permission to depart from the Pandavas and the Brahmins headed by Markandeya Rishi. After getting into his chariot, Krishna called for Satyabhama. After quickly embracing Draupadi, Satyabhama assured her, "Dear princess, your sons are being very lovingly cared for by Subhadra, Rukmini and many other exalted women, and so you should not worry." Satyabhama then mounted Krishna's chariot and the Lord set out for Dwarka. Okay, so that's the end of that pastime. And this is in Purnaprajna's. It means this is Purnaprajna's, the one that he produced, not Purnaprajna's that was produced by Nityananda. So then this is on page, starts on 264. Like that. We'll have to check in the full volume and see if there's more detail in this, but I'm sure this is the essential points. Okay. So any other questions?
Yes. So regarding the feelings between the husband and the wife's parents,
how do you deal?
The parents are really obnoxious, or they really have bad habits, and they're really dirty, or they're really unclean. But husband and wife go on well together, but they don't like each other's parents, or they don't, one doesn't like the parents of the other.
It means that in those situations, one deals properly. But one may, you know, not visit them that often. you know, one can try to reduce in some way.
Yeah. But it's not that we have to force ourselves to be pleasant with them.
No, you should be properly behaved and pleasant. That's what I'm saying, is that reduce how often you have to go. Like you see Prahlad Maharaj, his father's a demon. He dealt with him very nicely. You never see him behave in a way that's inappropriate for a son to be with a father. But it doesn't mean that he agrees. You know what I'm saying? You may be pleasant to them in dealings with them, but, you know, and they're saying so many things about what you're doing and not liking, then you just explain why you're doing, and if they don't like, what can you do? You know? But you don't necessarily have to, or if they ask you something, then you can explain why. But in your explanation, it should be presented pleasantly so that they're not offended. But at the same time, you can speak directly the truth. Like Prahlad Maharaj was saying, you know, he was telling him that, you know, the best thing I've learned is, you know, this worship of Vishnu. And he was telling him, you know, you, like all others, then are controlled by all this and that. But he wasn't saying it in a nasty way. So that's just the basic principle. You can say what you want to say, but it should be said pleasantly. That's all. You know, because they are senior, you know, at least in this way, by age. And if they don't respect the principle of you having more knowledge though you're younger than that, then what can you do? You know what I'm saying? You still perform, you still deal with them properly because of their age. Age and relations. So by age and relations, then they're senior. You know? But maybe on other things, they're not. By sacrifice and by knowledge, they're lower. And those are more important. Right? Wealth is the lowest, then family, then age, then you know, sacred rites, means how much sadhana and other things are, the depth of that, and then the final is knowledge. So they may have something on amongst those lower three, but they won't on the higher two. But if they don't recognize it, still doesn't mean that's what they're supposed to recognize in you. But that doesn't mean you don't recognize in them those qualities. By age and by family relations, they're seniors. So you deal with them like that. But they're supposed to reciprocate by seeing your sadhana and knowledge, which they don't. But that's their problem, not yours. You're doing your duty properly, they're not doing theirs. So they'll suffer for that. But you will deal with yours. So then, if it's agreeable, then you visit them as less, you know, that'll be least disturbing.
Does not consider the husband
if he expects you to go, then it's one of those things. But if he doesn't mind, if he understands and doesn't mind, then great. You know? But if somehow or another he really is bent out of shape about that, then it's one of the austerities. That's the whole thing. The whole thing's a give and take. In that, that's why it's best to know all these things before, you know, like that, or at least figure it out while you're going. You know, communications are good. Then it should be there. You can always recommend why. Like Parvati is, I mean, Sati is telling Shiva why she wants to go and this and that. He's not favorable, like that. So he's not appreciating. But it doesn't mean that he doesn't take care. She went, he comes behind. Things as well as, he knows something's going to happen. Okay. You know, so both are like that. But the main thing is that communication. Like that. She tried to explain things very nicely. You know, she came to form as Kumari, you know, very sweet and that, and Durga, and more, you know, like that, and then went on through the whole Dasa Mahavidya. So when she got to the point with her head cut off, naked head cut off, blood spurting out, going into her own head, and then you know, like that with the chopper, and then her associates are drinking the blood, then she was said, okay. You know, so she, you know, there was they had open communication. Is that okay? Anything else? No. Okay. So then, yeah. So Thursday we'll continue with. Now it goes into domestic concerns. Then the laws concerning husband and wife. So we'll hand these out on Thursday. Yes.
The whole family isolates that person from the friends of one another.
Mm-hmm.
So then like in Vaishnava society, it's not happening quite like that. We try to help them understand and make an offense.
Yeah, but when you're trying to understand, make an offense, the relationship has been set back to neutrality.
Yeah.
So the point is it'll go to neutrality in the family, because here's a person that doesn't know how to behave. But that means the family that is close. You know, if you have parts of the family that aren't close, then it's not so important. But you see that even then, when Duryodhana went to insult Yudhishthira by going down to Dvaitavan, where they were, you know, in the forest, and taking, you know, they went with all their wives and their women and their maidservants and their opulence and their chariots and their army and their, you know, like this. But when they got there, then they found some Gandharvas there. And Gandharvas said, "Go back, we're here enjoying ourselves. You go somewhere else." So they started to fight. And then in that fight, the Gandharvas captured Duryodhana. Duryodhana? Who? Dushasana? Karna? Well, Duryodhana was there, but also I think some of his brothers and their women, you know, which you don't do. When there's a battle, you don't capture the other guy's women. You know, you capture the men. The women are left out of it. So they captured everybody. And so then soldiers in that escaped, then they escaped and went to the Pandavas and said, "All this is going on, you please save them. Help us." So then Bhima was thinking, "Hey, great, yeah, Gandharvas finally are, you know, putting things right, you know." But then Yudhishthira said no, because they're members of the Kuru dynasty. We can't have the Gandharvas coming here and taking our women and insulting like this. We can't have this. So except for Yudhishthira, who had made a vow not to fight, you know, just to live a simple life. But he ordered that his brothers go and free them. So they went, fought with the Gandharvas and freed them. So then the Gandharvas then, after they defeated them, then, you know, then they said, "Now you give back, you know, Duryodhana and company." And I think they let the women go.
Because Arjuna argued that you can't keep the women.
Yeah, so then they let them go. Like that. Because it is true. They just did it to annoy Duryodhana, but they let them go. And but they said, "But don't ask us to take them, because Indra sent us to do this, because we knew they were coming here to harass you, so to teach them a lesson. So Indra wants to see them, you know, he wants to chastise them." So then Arjuna said, "No, but Yudhishthira has instructed us that they must be freed." You know, so out of respect for Yudhishthira, because Yudhishthira is respected in the universe, because by his performance of sacrifice and this and that, the demigods are being taken care of, because he's so pious. You know, his virtue is that. So then they said, "Okay, then let us go talk to Yudhishthira, and then whatever he says, we'll do." You know, means they made the point that Yudhishthira is saying that you free the cousins, because he's thinking that they just came down here to count their cows, and by chance they were, you know, inappropriately behaved with the Gandharvas, and they got themselves into trouble. But when he finds out that actually they came here just to harass him, and that Indra has sent us to correct that situation, he may say differently. But whatever he says, if he says yes, take him to Indra, then that's what we'll do. And if he says no, free them, we'll free them. You know, because the point is Indra was only doing this, you know, for the pleasure of Yudhishthira. And so if Yudhishthira is more pleased that they're freed, then that's to be done. So then they went, told everything to Yudhishthira. They were received very nicely. And then after explaining, then Yudhishthira said no, because, you know, they're our family, the Kuru dynasty. We are the Kurus. So therefore, you know, if he wanted to please him, then let them go. So they let him go, and the Gandharvas left. Like that. Does that make some sense? So there is that sense of the family is there, even if it's a members of the family who aren't. But in that, they're all following the tradition. So the Kuru dynasty is a tradition. You know, when you're dealing with first generation and all that, what's behind may not be, you know, considered the greatest in Vaishnava tradition and stuff. Plus, then you have the added element that as devotees who are trying to go back to Godhead, then a lot of these things become basically secondary. They're not primary things. So, in other words, what is going to actually be useful for spiritual advancement, that becomes the primary thing. And so if dealing with the other members of the family like that, it's not favorable, then it won't work. It's not important. But the point is in any case, someone who's offensive, one's relationship with them may be reduced to a neutral point till they can correct themselves. Here it said persona non grata. It didn't mean that they become inimical towards them. It just means that they just don't deal with them. Does that make some sense? Like, they may be the husband's enemy, but it doesn't mean they're the wife's enemy. It just means that the wife doesn't deal with them. Because, you know. Is that okay? Anything else? Or? No? Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jayanita Gauru Pena.